AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm David Canfield, and I'm here for this week's interview episode with Richard Lawson. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
We're going to start this week's episode with my interview with Kiefer Sutherland, who is the scene-stealing star of the Caine Mutiny Court Martial, a television movie directed by the late William Friedkin, which is now streaming on Paramount Plus with Showtime. I'm still getting used to saying that new name for Showtime. And a little bit later, we have an interview with Ambika Ahmad, the star of One Day, which is streaming on Netflix. But Richard, I think we're both fans of Caine Mutiny Court Martial, this new take on the film. Of course, the original one starred Humphrey Bogart. And Kiefer Sutherland has stepped into the role of Captain Queeg, and I would say acquits himself quite well.
Yeah, I would say that I'm sort of doubly grateful for this movie because, well, for one thing, it's well made and very well acted, I think, particularly by Kiefer Sutherland, but also because it was the perfect thing. I came home for some holiday, Thanksgiving or Christmas last year with, you know, screener links and all this stuff, and my dad just wasn't really interested in any of it. And then I was like, wait, I think that Caine Mutiny movie is on Showtime. And so he was like, oh yeah, I know that. That was a play or you know, it's a movie. And so we put it on and I was so blown away by how good it is, how compelling it is. You know, it's the last film by a great director, but really Kiefer Sutherland in particular, he's playing very out of character, like out of type, I guess. And I think he really pulls it off and then some.
Yeah. He's had a long history of playing characters who aren't exactly the most likable. That can go even back to his teenage years in movies like Stand By Me. And as we were talking, it's something that he says has weighed quite heavily on him.
The thing I didn't understand at 15 was that people take their movies really seriously and they take them really personal. I have had occasion where, you know, someone would not shake my hand because of a part that I played.
But with this one, you know, Queeg is a fascinating figure because there is this exterior of confidence and certitude that is really just pummeled in this film by Jason Clark, who plays the attorney opposite him. And the way Kiefer, I think, really precisely plays that breakdown is fascinating to watch and totally different from, say, the man who brought Jack Bauer to life.
I think it's a really delicate balance for it. You know, I think a lot of like straight male actors, they can play military authority that's like, okay, that's a pretty stock character to do. But to add the sort of extra seasoning of, but that authority is a bit pompous and maybe misguided because they're not actually that competent or they've faded in their ability. Like it's a vulnerable character in a strange way. And I think to kind of really thread that needle of maybe once was competent, but has sort of fallen down or become too reliant on discipline and not really like thinking holistically about his work. It's a certain role that in a way might be called daring because it shows a weakness that I think a lot of actors, especially of Sutherland's generation, generations older than him, were not really trained to show very often.
And that's something we talked a lot about in our interview as well, and something he's been reflecting on. So let's get into the interview with Kiefer Sutherland. Well, we have Kiefer Sutherland here today, star of the Caine Mutiny Court Martial. Hi, Kiefer.
How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for being here. I love this movie. It took me by surprise. I think I saw it before Venice last year, so it's been a minute. I imagine it's been even longer for you.
It has, unfortunately. I mean, so many kind of events between COVID and the writer's strike, then the SAG strike and everything just made kind of the release of this film just fragmented is the best way to say it. And so I think now we're slowly just trying to do some press because I think it's a really special piece of work. I think William Friedkin is not just one of the great American directors of all time. He's one of the great film directors of all time. And I think very few people can actually say that they've changed two genres of film in a span of 3 years. William Friedkin directed The French Connection, which absolutely changed the genre of the thriller. And he was also then very quickly, soon after, responsible for The Exorcist, which absolutely changed the genre of horror films as we know it. And so it was such an honor to be able to work with him. And it was unfortunate that his last film came out in such a troubled time. But it was even obviously more sad that he passed before it came out. So I'm very excited for people to see it because as much as that I am in it and I am proud of my performance and I'm proud of all of the other actors, the story behind the making of this movie and the incredible talent that was on display was pretty extraordinary. We shot the film in 2 weeks, which is unheard of for a feature-length film.
Unbelievable.
And the very last sequence that I'm in two parts of the movie, and they're split up by two different kinds of testimony that I provide in the course of the film. The second piece of testimony is somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes long. That was all done from entrance to exit in one take. And it's not so much that we were capable of doing it in one take. That's you take your time, you learn it, and you do your job. The real extraordinary thing is that he had seven cameras moving at the same time in a very small space, which was that courtroom. To have seven cameras working like that in Congress with each other is one of the most kind of off the chart games of Tetris I've ever seen. And he did it with a kind of skill that was just so matter of fact. We didn't really even get full rehearsals because he knew what he wanted the cameras to do and told each operator specifically what their requirement was. And we shot it. And I've never felt kind of a sense of synthesis on a set like I did that one when he was orchestrating what ended up being almost a 28-minute segment. It was pretty extraordinary to watch. And it was his skill level like that that allowed us to shoot the film as well as we did, in my opinion, but also as fast as we did.
I love everything you said, and particularly the fact that this is a film that is one scene and that requires a certain level of finesse to keep it moving, keep it interesting, keep it cinematic, which I think he does so brilliantly. I'm wondering how it was presented to you, an update of the Caine Mutiny, kind of iconic character, William Friedkin. Like, how did it come to you? How did you wrap your head around it?
In all fairness, it came in kind of the most old school of traditional ways. And by that, I just mean, like, he wasn't going through an agent. He called me up. And then I got the voicemail, which was, hi, this is Billy Friedkin. And I had met him before through his wife, Sherry Lansing. And so I immediately called him back and he explained what he wanted to do. And I didn't interrupt him, but I mean, if he was calling me to do a film, I was going to do it. So, I mean, if he had said like, we're going to do the Yellow Pages, but in two parts and you're in part A to M, I'd be like, okay, cool. Right. I mean,
yep.
The fact that it was an iconic film to me by virtue of Humphrey Bogart and an iconic play, an iconic book, and it represented so many things that I was fascinated by, and for my character specifically, two things kind of collide together in the course of this film. And it's a man being confronted with who he is, not who he wants to be. And that's a terrible moment for anyone. And we all have it at some point in our lives where we realize at some point that we're not going to be the perfect ideal of who we wanted ourselves to be. And then depending on how kind of bad that moment is, you know, we have to reconcile with it. And obviously in the case of this story, the man that Queeg wanted to be and the man who he honestly was there was a vast difference between the two. And that, I think, is heartbreaking to kind of come to the realization that you missed your own mark. And the other thing that I found so kind of fascinating and that is such a part of the book is this notion of becoming irrelevant. That the U.S. Navy was willing to put up with some of Commander Queeg's misgivings because he was needed. He was needed during a world war. He was needed during this time. And now he's no longer needed. And how do we get rid of him with the least fuss of all? And I think that's another thing as you get older that you kind of are confronted with, that the world's moving on. It's not going to wait for you. And there is not going to be not even a day where the whole world mourns, you know, your passing. I think on some level, the only way we survive as humans is believing that at least within the context of our community, that we're important. And I think in this film, he's being shown that he's not. And I think those two things to collide at the same time are really devastating for a person. And so as much as I don't like some of Commander Queeg's traits myself as a person, I have great empathy for what he's going through in this film and in this story. And so, you know, it's also at a time in my life where, you know, on some level, I'm questioning, did I become, you know, how far off am I from the mark of the man that I wanted to be? And there's certainly things I wish I had done better. And you certainly can't help as you get older, start to kind of realize that there's a lot of other young people coming up and they're doing great work and you are less relevant than you might have been 10 or 15 years ago. So it's very interesting to play a part about a series of topics that you're actually dealing with as your own person. I try not to conflate the two, but I would be very hard pressed to say that they didn't kind of cross paths, you know, in the idea of that performance.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
You realize some of those psychological disconnects you were talking about in his physicality in a way I found incredibly compelling.
Oh, thank you.
Was your preparation unique for it, the way you went into it, seemingly from the inside out almost?
Well, very much so. I mean, the preparation was just the volume of dialogue that was going to have to be learned as a play. And unlike a play where you then, you know, you learn your dialogue and then you go into rehearsals and then you rehearse for 6 weeks and then you start performing it, that wasn't going to be an option here. So that I knew that I had to work with someone to actually put it on its feet, that I would have to perform it so that by the time I went to shoot with Mr. Friedkin, I had a real strong sense of what I was going to do with it because as a director, he's known for wanting, you know, the first one or two takes of a performance and for very justified reasons. You know, certainly in a courtroom drama, when someone's testifying and that much is at stake, they're inherently going to be nervous and they're inherently going to be scared. And that's very similar to an actor performing a first take of anything, right? They're inherently nervous and they're inherently scared. And so he wanted that natural kinetic energy to be kind of going through you for real in the circumstances of your performance.
It's the principle. The principle of respect for the command, and that principle was dead when I came aboard that ship and I brought it to life, and I nagged and I bitched and I hollered, and by God, I made it stick while I was captain. It was a matter of respect. When I ask a sailor a question, I want a straight answer. Nobody's going to get away with these shifty evasions if I have to hold a court of inquiry for a week. And on my ship, I wasn't going to let them get away with it, and I didn't. By God, I never let anything like that happen on that ship again.
So it started like that. And so the fact I worked with a woman named Beth Elliott, and so learned it top to bottom like a play, ran it top to bottom like a play. And the physicality started to find itself in places where I thought it was going to matter the most. The hands starting to move long before he ever gets to the ball bearings. The foot kind of wedging itself into kind of this uniquely uncomfortable position. All these little things kind of telling you how tortured this person is, while the rest of the facade kind of looks very presentable and cool and calm. But that inside, between the hands and the feet, this person's in real torture at this moment.
It felt like every actor was just at the top of their game here. I'm not sure if you got to, you know, hang around set in the scenes you weren't in, but it was thrilling to just see this company come together scene by scene by scene.
Well, and it was, and I'll tell you, and you're right. Every person, there were a lot of scenes that I wasn't privy to because I just wasn't there. But I'll give you a thing about Lance Riddick that I just thought was so cool. In that in that whole second testimony of mine, I think he has one line. And as I said earlier, the take was like 28 minutes long, or whatever it is in the film is however long it was from kind of end to end. And there wasn't a single moment, because I had about five cameras directly in front of me, and Lance was just on my right over that last camera, and then to my far right, and then to my far left, was Jason. Everybody else was kind of blocked by the cameras. I couldn't see them. And so I really had two points of reference. And the combative reference is always going to be with Jason, right? So when I'm defending myself and I'm trying to stake my claim, it's always going to be to Jason. When I'm trying to look up for some understanding and some empathy from my Navy, it was always Lance. Now, I didn't expect him to do what he did, but I've never seen anyone stay that laser focused for a 28-minute take with one line. There wasn't a single moment that I wouldn't kind of look up at him, and representing all the people behind that desk, that he either wasn't either locked eyes with me or locked eyes with Jason for me to react to. But he was absolutely 100% there. And for actors to be that generous when they're off camera and they don't have a lot of dialogue is really rare. I respect Lance incredibly for what he gave in the moments that he was performing and that we were working line by line with each other. But I also really came to respect the incredible gift that he gave me as an off-camera actor, which I don't, you know, it's, I mean, historically, you don't get that very often.
That's lovely. And it's interesting. I revisited the film a little bit just before this, and you feel that there is this sense of loss to the film with Friedkin and with Lance. And there's a poignancy to it as well, though, I think.
Well, first, the poignancy is just the fleeting nature of it, right? I mean, you wouldn't find a better looking, stronger looking man than Lance. You just won't. I mean, and so that just doesn't make sense. And that gets you into the whole world of that was just not fair, right? And and my heart breaks for his wife, for his family and friends. And you just have to take solace in kind of what an amazing man he was and how many great things he did. But that's never going to be enough, and certainly not for the people that surrounded him. And then William, I think that's the first time I've called him William.
That may be my fault.
No, because I always called him Mr. Freakin. And I started off with Sir. And then he kept saying, you need to call me Billy. And I said, yeah, I can't do that. And then it ended up Mr. Freakin. And I said, look, you have to understand. I was a theater actor in Toronto, Canada. And I was 15 years old and I went and saw The French Connection. And this is before VHS. This is before Beta. This was a second, third run of the movie. No, I've never seen a trailer for it. I just went to go see it because I'd heard it was something to see. And after that, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to tell stories like that. And I wanted to tell them like that. I wanted to tell them that violently. And I wanted to tell them that impactfully and that current and that dynamic. And so I said, yeah, there's no way I'm calling you Billy. You know, I'm going to talk to you with a level of respect that I think you deserve. So that actually, yeah, I think just kind of thinking of him in memory made me call him William. But he had so much energy and so much spirit. And, you know, look, coming out of COVID, all this stuff, it's been a tough time. And then it's been a tough time on people that are older. And he was so vital when we were working that I was really caught off guard when he passed. And I think it's very sad because I think it would have been really nice for him. I think as tough as he sounds and as tough as he is, I think he would have been very appreciative of the way people have taken his last film. And I would have liked him to have seen that.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
I'd love to go back a bit to what you were saying about how you connect to Queeg. Mainly because I've been a fan of yours for a long time.
Thank you.
But I've been really interested in some of the work you've done for screen more recently. I guess the way to ask this is like, how are you observing roles coming your way versus what you're looking for? Because something like They Clone Tyrone was such a cool change of pace for you, or even playing FDR.
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head. I mean, what comes your way? You know, so much of it is that, right? I mean, Mr. Freakin was a fan of 24, and I had done a film with his wife, Sherry Lansing, at Paramount called Eye for an Eye, which was a really hard film for me to make because the character was so awful, but I really appreciated the story. And John Schlesinger was the director, and I wanted to work with the director. And I think Mr. Freakin appreciated the fact that I was willing to take a role that was going to risk my entire career because I wanted to work with a director. I mean, the fact that I got offered this opportunity is extraordinary. And so much of it is, I think the one benefit of getting older is that I think some of the younger people that might be hiring you have no idea what you've done. and they just, so they're willing to take a chance on you doing something different because they, you know, they either don't know any better or they actually think you can do something different. Because certainly when I started, when I take a look back on, and I wish I'd been a little smarter, but when I look back on Stand By Me, Lost Boys, Flatliners, Young Guns 1 and 2 are a bit different because I wasn't the bad guy in those movies. But then when you start thinking of A Few Good Men, A Time to Kill, and all of the films that followed, and Eye for an Eye at kind of the height of that, those were all characters that were just kind of nasty and not nice at all. And my rationalization as an actor is, well, if those characters aren't kind of awful, then the good part of this story can't be told. So there's a responsibility there. The thing I didn't understand at 15 was that people take their movies really seriously and they take them really personal. And I have had occasion where, you know, someone would not shake my hand because of a part that I played. And
wow.
I mean, I personally don't understand that. It's a movie, but I've had to kind of accept it. And Eye for an Eye was very hard that way. I mean, I do remember, I mean, kind of on a funnier note, about a week after that had come out, my daughter was maybe 8 years old and we went to Chuck E. Cheese and I ordered a pizza. And by the time we got to the table, all the other mothers had grabbed their kids and just left. And literally, we were the only people left in this restaurant that sat like 1,000 people. And wow. My daughter thought I'd rented the place out for us. And that's, of course, not the truth. It was just the character was just, unfortunately, that. I mean, it's just a terrible, I mean, and as a father of a daughter, the worst father of two daughters, the worst kind of character that you would ever want your daughter to come in contact with. So it's been hard that in the earlier stages of my career, but you're always just so grateful to work. So being given other opportunities, like they clone Tyrone, and the pandemic had something to do with it, I think. Less people were available. So you take whatever opportunity you can, you do the best you can with it, and you're grateful to have had it. So yes, I'm embracing the idea that with age comes opportunity and nuanced change, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call them, you know, bigger swings or anything, but when you're a leading man, as you've been in, for example, a number of series, there's a certain, you know, you're holding the center a little bit more, whereas in something like Caine Mutiny, you come in and the energy is electric.
Well, thank you.
In those other projects as well, it's more unpredictable, I guess is right. A good way of putting it.
Well, and it's a fantastic opportunity because, I mean, if you think of actors as you know, as a storyteller, actors are your weapons, right? If there's something that you can do that can be effective, I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about any actor. If there's, you know, when you take a look at Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, I would have to tell you he's barely in a quarter of it. But the impact he has is so great, and the performance that he gives is so profound that he's with you through the whole film and the whole storytelling process. And so as an actor, you would relish those kinds of opportunities to allow yourself kind of the power of telling and being a part of the telling of that story. Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men was a perfect example of that. I would say he was in less than a quarter of that movie. And yet commanded so much attention.
I know you just worked with another master, Mr. Clint Eastwood.
Yes, yeah.
What can you tell me about that experience and really doing films like this in succession with these kinds of, I mean, these pillars of filmmaking?
Well, so this is actually a really kind of a funny story. So I had such an amazing time with Mr. Friedkin, and then as you're saying that these other opportunities were presenting themselves, and then I had read that Clint Eastwood was making his last film, and I knew that it had been predominantly cast, but I wrote him a letter saying, you know, introducing myself, telling him that one of the great dreams of my life would have been to have been in a film that he had made, and that there was no part that would be too small. If there's anything, if it was a couple lines, if it's the greatest extra part of all time, I'm in. I would like to just be there, and I would like to say I was a part of it. And so the part that I ended up getting was not a big part, but it was a really impactful part for me when I read the script. And I was just so excited to do it. And there was the first scene that I did was in a house, and it's hard to tell the story, but I'm introducing myself to another character, and we're kind of becoming neighbor friends, and there was a tricky moment of how to navigate the last couple lines of the scene and then get out of the house. And as I was leaving, I just kind of made enough room between myself, camera, and the door, which was really narrow. And I only had a few inches on each side. And I used a line to bridge what looked like kind of maybe an awkward way out. And as I was starting to initiate that move, the first AD went to go say something. And I heard way off in the background, Clint Eastwood said, "No, don't. He knows what he's doing." And I got out the door. I've had a really incredibly fortunate career, but that's a moment that it'll last me forever, right? That for one brief moment, Clint Eastwood told his first AD of 25 years not to worry that I would figure it out. And he didn't fire me, so I figured I did.
Next, we're going to turn to our interview with Ambit Kamad. Katie Rich recorded this interview in early March before leaving Little Gold Men. Richard and I are both huge fans of the series One Day. I watched it on Richard's recommendation. And Ambika is an actress I was aware of before the series, but I think in this one, playing opposite Leah Woodall, we see just how great she is.
Yeah, they're perfectly matched. I think, you know, he's got the rich boy, sad-eyed swagger going, and she's got the, you know, from a lower class, but like smarter than him and more ambitious than him, but frustrated by the limitations put on her by her station or whatever. They really balance each other well. But the good thing about One Day is that, like, they get episodes where they're not interacting, so they just get to show us what they can do separate of each other. And Maude is just like, she's a frustrated post-grad trying to make a living in theater, which is something I can, I don't know, maybe relate to.
Oh, God, it's so nice to be out. It's been so long.
Not that long. Look lovely.
Oh, no, I don't.
Cool shoes.
Saxon, $12.99.
One day I'm going to give you a compliment and you won't immediately reply with the price.
No, never.
And I just find that the way that her character evolves from, you know, theater artist to writer to, frustrated writer to writer who is actually maybe making some traction, but kind of doubtful of that while also having romantic misadventures. Like, I just really feel like you grow up with her over the course of the show. And that's the writing and the direction, sure, but it's really in the performance.
Yeah, there's a quiet heartbreak that she weaves into the whole piece as well. So let's get into our interview with Ambit Kamad.
I wanted to start by going back to kind of before the show started from stuff I think you talked about in earlier interviews, just basically how the reaction to This Is Going to Hurt was so huge and made you kind of, I don't know if anxious is the word, but really considering what you wanted to do next and made you not want to take this audition in the first place. Can you just talk about what that feeling was like about that show blowing up so big and how it affected what you figured you wanted to do next with your career?
Yeah, I think the reaction to This Is Gonna Hurt blew all our expectations out the water. Like, it was my first sort of breakout role. And the reaction, especially like in this country, to my character's storyline, it massively, like, I think, just surpassed every expectation I had of the show. People really fell in love with that character and were really devastated by her storyline. I mean, just to be clear, like, her storyline, so she's a junior doctor who struggles with depression and then she ends up taking her own life, which is actually a worryingly high statistic for junior doctors in the UK. Yeah. And it became like, I think it sort of struck up this national conversation. And I found myself sort of very much in the middle of this, you know, this moment. And as an actor sort of having her first breakthrough, like I was just quite overwhelmed. And it's that whole thing of like, you know, when you feel like you're getting too much attention. Mm-hmm. So you're like, everyone, go away, please. And that's sort of what I felt when I, you know, got the audition for One Day. And I was like, no, not doing that. Thank you. Very nice of you to offer, but goodbye. And also because I was such a massive fan of the book, like a massive fan of the book. I'd read the book when it came out and I was like 13 or 14. So it kind of just felt like this other thing that would also carry huge responsibility for different reasons. And I didn't think I was up to the task.
I know you've known you wanted to be an actor for a long time and you had done, you know, press when going to the Edinburgh Fringe and stuff like that. But when you're in something like This Is Going to Hurt that's so topical and everyone wants to talk to you about doctors and mental health and all this stuff, did the kind of becoming a spokesperson surprise you? Did it feel like you were all of a sudden being asked to speak for things and you're like, I'm an actor, like I work in a hospital?
I know. The weirdest thing was like when people would come up to me on the street and doctors, it'd be primarily doctors who would approach me and they'd come up to me, they'd be like, thank you so much. And I'd be like, what are you thanking me for? I'm an actor. You're an actual doctor. Like, this feels like the wrong way around. And that was really, that I found that very confusing and very wild because I did so much research for that job. There was about, I was cast, I think, a couple of months before we actually started filming, and I was so terrified of the responsibility, which seems to be a recurring theme, that like I just dove straight into like research. Like, I watched every documentary, I read every book, listened to every podcast. I read up about like people's experience at medical school. I read up about like PTSD that obs and gynae doctors have, depression, suicide. I read up about like the junior doctor strikes that had happened, how the NHS differs from like how it works now to how it worked when the show was set in 2006, like everything. And so I kind of felt like almost like fully in this world, even though I was not at all involved in the world. I felt like I knew so much about it. So I think when the show came out and it got that reception, I felt very proud and like the show had done its job. Like the show was so much bigger than all of us. You know, the show was created to represent these people who are underpaid and underappreciated, dealing with life and death every day in their lines of work. And I could help be a spokesperson that in some way, whether it's literally talking about it in an interview or just, you know, via my performance. Like it's rare you get to do work that is not only fun and like complex and meaty, but like it's also really meaningful and brings a lot of social awareness to something that really deserves it. So it just kind of felt like the perfect amalgamation of everything. And I'm, you know, it's definitely set a really high bar in terms of like that being my breakout role. It's definitely set a really high bar for the things I do after it.
Well, and then one day comes and you don't have the pressure of representing something so broad. You know, you're playing like a quote unquote normal person, kind of with regular feelings. But a love story people put so much into, like people are invested in M and Dex like you were when you were 13. So I imagine that comes with its own pressure, too, of being true to the story that you love and also just like having an audience who you know is going to care really deeply about this. Did that pressure feel palpable to you when you started?
100%. Again, I think it's part of the reason that I turned the audition down. And then it was only when I sort of a month or so later revisited the first script that they'd sent and realized and remembered how much I'd loved these characters and this story and how much it meant to me growing up that I changed my mind and sent off a tape in 2 days, like at the 11th hour. I think for Emma especially, I felt that responsibility because for anyone who knows the book, like everyone who knows the book knows that one day is Emma's book. She is the grounding force of that novel. She is the one that people relate to and identify with. You know, David Nichols said it himself that when he wrote the book and it came out and it was such a success that he had people coming up to him all the time telling him, I am Emma. I like see myself in Emma. Like no one ever said that about Dexter. You know, she is the person whose eye, through whose eyes we see the story and we feel like we grow up with her in a way. And I think there's so much about her story that's so universal and she's so loved by so many different people for so many different reasons. And I was also very aware that I could just bring about one version of her. Like I'm not going to be able to satisfy everyone's interpretations of her. And I think, you know, after that initial pressure and initial responsibility kind of washed over me, I was then left with the task of just actually, you know, the best thing I can do now is find my own truthful version of Emma. And I think, you know, nothing to mention the fact that, you know, Emma's written as white. She's been played by a white actress in the past. Like there was obviously like, it felt, there almost felt like this need for me to be able to like justify why I was there playing the role. But the creative team, the writers, the execs, they never asked that of me. And what we did instead was just like going into creating this really complex, detailed backstory for her so that she felt as real to us as possible when we then, when, you know, we then started creating the show. And I, you know, did as much research as I could into like what it might have been growing up in Yorkshire in the 60s and the 70s and, you know, what her family might have looked like, what her schooling might have looked like. And so, yeah, I think the responsibility of the pressure is something that came over me in sort of waves at different times. But all I could do was tap into the reasons that I identified with Emma and the reasons why she felt so real and so truthful to me as a person. And yeah, hopefully that comes across.
I think it's really easy to imagine, even when you're 13 and you haven't had these life experiences, why you'd identify with Emma. You know, at that age when you feel like you're smarter than everybody and maybe feel like you say the wrong thing all the time. There's a lot there. Revisiting her and this story in general at, you know, roughly halfway through the story in terms of the age you are now, did you get something different out of it? Did you kind of look back at your 13-year-old self and say, oh, wow, we get the story feels so different? Because I felt that way having read the book 12 years ago and now reading it again. It felt so different to me, and I'm betting it was the same for you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when you're 13 and you read a story like that, there's like this notion of like, I'm going to find my one true love and everything's going to be fine. And like when I reread the book when I was auditioning and then I reread it again when I got the part, it meant something completely different to me. And now I don't even look at it as a love story anymore. And I'm really hesitant to call it that. And in every press interview I've done, I've been really hesitant to call it that. Because yes, it's just one part of the narrative. And Emma and Dexter are just one part of each other's lives. But like, actually, this book is about so much more than that. It's about growing up and how brutal and disappointing that can be. I think it's about fate. And I think that is actually a much, much more profound way to look at the story. And that's my relationship with it. I, having reread the book so many times now and having made the show, I think I'm much more reflective about life. Maybe that's just a quality that comes as you get older, where I look back on my life and it's the small encounters and the seemingly small accidents that have made a massive impact on my life and where I am today and the relationships that I have. And I think that's definitely true of Emma and Dexter. When they first meet, it's not this cosmic union. It's a bit stilted, it's a bit awkward. Like, they're clearly sort of two very different people from two very different worlds. But the impact they have on each other and each other's lives is hugely profound. And I think, you know, with a lot of our relationships, we look back and might not have predicted the ways in which different people might have stuck around in our life and the impact that they might have had. So I think it's, you know, much bigger than just a love story. I think it's about how actually life unfolds in the most unexpected ways, for good and for bad.
Yeah. I think the part that felt maybe the most poignant for me different now is kind of Emma's early years trying to figure out what she wants to do with herself, and that sense of like, I'm struggling, I have this terrible job, I'm never going to get out of this terrible job. And I think you had a pretty similar post-college thing of trying to make it as an artist, having a lot of artist friends, and just hitting roadblock after roadblock. So having the perspective now where you've kind of gotten out of that, did those sequences hit differently for you?
Definitely. I came out of uni pursuing comedy because I'm a comedian originally, and I was working full-time jobs and gigging in the evenings and writing on the weekends and feeling really just like beaten down by the whole like rigmarole of it. Every time you think you get close to something, it goes away. And also like Emma, like when you feel like such an outsider to the industry, like I didn't have any connections, trying to get your foot in the door, creating your own work, like it's exhausting. It's really exhausting. It's really vulnerable. The rejection in comedy is brutal. And I think when I reread that, because, you know, I was 26 when I got the part, so I, you know, hadn't lived much of Emma's life, but I, especially in those early years of, you know, she has something to say and she has this currency of like her wit and her intelligence, and she's very moralistic and she wants to change the world, but she is just not the kind of person who get, like, she feels like an underdog. She feels very separate and very outside of the rooms where she can make those changes or pursue her dreams, like follow her ambitions. And I think that's definitely a part of her story that I really, really, really related to, especially when you contrast her with someone like Dexter, who is just like has all the privilege in the world and gets everything handed to him on a silver platter. Like, that can make it feel even more frustrating. Like having to sort of work 10 times harder to get half as far. And I think that's, you know, definitely something.
Did you know people like that too? Did you have Dexters in your own life who you just watched going upward while you tried to get your foot in the door?
Not like close to me, but like there's, you know, privilege definitely helps in this industry. Like, I mean, not to sugarcoat it. So like it can kind of feel like I am just not the kind of thing that people want. It's very easy to feel like I'm not the kind of person that people want to see on screen. I'm not the kind of person that people want playing this character. I'm not the kind of person that people will like look up to and like empathize with or fall in love with. So it's like kind of overcoming all those barriers. And like, that is, you know, I think a story that a lot of young women can relate to, because we get told time and time again that we're not enough or that we're too much of something. And that we're, you know, so it's, you know, I think that's why so many people, like I said earlier, identify with Emma, and especially sort of her feelings in her early 20s. Yeah, that definitely rang true for me, and it was helpful to get into her, into the character in that way.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
I love what you've said about what the very visible rejection you got, like on stage performing comedy, where sometimes you just bomb and the room is silent and you have to power through that and what you've learned from that. And I wondered, like, does it build confidence? Does it kind of teach you to hone your skills? What do you now feel like you really got from just falling flat on your face in front of a crowd once in a while?
Everything, honestly. Honestly, everything. Comedy gave me everything. I think more than anything, it gave me my voice. I think I've, you know, really learned who I am. And I think as an actor, like, that is such, you know, as much as you want to play different parts and lose yourself in different stories, like, as an actor, you really need to know who you are, because at the end of the day, it's about the choices you make and the things that you stand up for. And that's what I really learned in comedy. Also, just like the difference in rejection of dying on stage, as you say, versus sending a tape off and never hearing back. Like, that is just, like, worlds apart. So, I, you know, when I started acting and auditioning, I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. I was like, this is fine. I can just be rejected in the privacy of my own home. It's fine. There isn't, like, a group of 50 people staring at me, hating me, wondering why this little brown girl is ruining their, like, wasting their evening. So it's, like, it's a very, very different process. And I think, similarly to Emma, like, I think when I went into audition rooms as an actor, my comedy training was my currency. And it's always what I brought to every scene, brought to every role, is finding that levity. Because I think as humans, we do lean into that much more than perhaps we, you know, see on TV and film. So that was always, you know, my instinct.
Is there something from making One Day where you, like an episode or a scene or anything, where you felt your comedy training come in the most? There's a lot of drama in the show, obviously, but there's a ton of comedy to it. And I wonder if any of it rang more of a bell with your previous experience.
I think what comedy taught me and what I tried to bring to sort of more dramatic moments is that, like, less is more. I can't remember who said it. I think it might have been like George Clooney, like on an actor's, inside the actor's studio, when he said something about, like, you know, actors always try to cry. People don't want to cry in real life. And like something about that always stuck with me, that like I'm always looking for the most interesting choice or the most interesting take on a scene or in a moment or on a line read. And I think that's something definitely comes from my like improv training, is that in this world, no matter how mad it is, you could be in a restaurant eating fish out of hats, that world is like grounded to those people in it. And like, what is the most interesting choice that you can make that feels real, but that will push the scene along? And I think for me, acting wise, like, it's always about like just making those interesting choices and but also like trying to do as little as possible. I think that that's what comedy really taught me. Like, you know, obviously a joke lands because it's unexpected. And I think I have a similar outlook to acting, is like, I think the best performances always shock you, even if they're the most dramatic performances that you've ever seen.
I was thinking about in the Paris episode where you meet Emma and she's grown up and she's come into herself, but it's small. Like, she's aged a little bit, but is a different person, but is not really a different person. And that made me think of what you said about the small choice being the right choice sometimes. So I wonder if that one felt right for you.
Absolutely. I almost think like the most confident people, the people who know themselves the best, have the least to prove. Mm-hmm. And there's something so quietly confident about Emma when we meet her in Paris. You know, she's working on her second book. She's in this beautiful city. She's met this guy. She's seeing, and there's something so quietly confident and quietly assured about just her whole, I think, demeanor. And that was, I think, definitely something I tried to carry in that episode. Because I also think that's just how growing up kind of works. I think, you know, as we get older, we want more peaceful, quieter lives. You know, in your 20s, there's so much room for drama and emotion and those high peaks and troughs. And I think as you get older, you want the stability of that calm, flat line. Do you know what I mean? You want people you can trust and people who are reliable and people you love and, you know, work that you love and is secure. So it's something about, I think there's something about that that like sits very well with Emma when we meet her in Paris. And especially when we then see her and Dexter's life together, like it's a very ordinary life. And I think that's what I think that the writing and has done so beautifully. I mean, across the whole series, but especially when Emma and Dexter get together, is it's the small moments. Like life lives in the small moments. When I think you're younger, as I was saying earlier, you think it's about the big moments, finding the love of your life, finding your dream job. But with Emma and Dexter, it's about the small joys within the days that we see them together. And again, I think the beauty of that facilitated, again, just always picking the most interesting but smallest choice.
Yeah. I read in another interview you said that now that, you know, you've had these two big acting roles, that you'd like to do some more writing of your own or kind of build your own projects. Is there anything specific you have in mind of what you'd want to write or what you'd want to focus on that would be entirely yours?
I have a couple of ideas. I would love to sort of go back to my comedy roots. I think a lot of people who see me on TV might not know that that's my background and that's where I come from. I would love to do something like really off the wall and a bit weird, that's like very character driven. It's always been my dream to write a really good like ensemble comedy. And I'm talking like bottle episode-esque, five people in a room, just really five clear-cut characters performed by really amazing, comedically skilled actors. And then putting them in a situation where like there's nowhere for the writing to hide. Like the writing has to be as strong. That's kind of like a dream of mine. And I think finding the right setting for that. But I have a lot of things that I would like to do and a lot of people I'd love to work with. But I think, you know, being an actor, you kind of have to relinquish control a lot of the time. I would love to have a bit more, you know, control over a project and be there from the very beginning to the very end rather than just coming in, doing my bit and then going. But I'm happy for that to come to me in whichever way that does, and I'm in no rush.
That does it for this week's interview episode. We will be back on Thursday to discuss the Cannes lineup, which Richard and I are very excited about. In the meantime, you can find me on the internet at DavidCanfield97, and Richard?
Murai Laws.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.